Well, hello again there, everybody. Let me just check in the chat there. I think we should be up and running, everybody. I like how there's the same classic movies regulars are filtering into the chat there. Hello, where Woodland are? I think, yeah, I should really make Woodland a mod if I can figure out how I do it all. But here we are. We're back again then. We're live. How are you doing, Endeavour? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm doing great.
So today we've got Demolition Man, 1993. This is one of those films that everybody talks about. I don't think it's like a great sort of I don't think it's like a great sort of classic movie, if you know what I mean. All right. I think I must be coming through okay. So let's get down to business then. We've got Demolition Man. I don't think it's a classic movie. I think it's a push to say that it's like you know how like we did Zulu last time, and we've done like all these great old sort of mighty dinosaurs of movies. Like I don't think this is this. I don't think to be fair, let's just sort of get it in at the start. I don't think Demolition Man is a classic movie in any like real sense of the word. But it is one of those, it's kind of become a classic because everybody says it's got these weird themes in it and it predicted the future. And so over time, I mean, this was the kind of turning point in Sylvester Stallone's career where he kind of tried to transition into being a bit, they all did this as well. I'll probably come back to this later. But they all the 80s action movie stars began to sort of transition into more kind of friendly, sort of a bit less harsh kind of movies in the 90s. Schwarzenegger did another what he did a Schwarzenegger did one. I can't have the name slip my mind. It was a James Cameron one, and that was kind of like a self parody, and they began to sort of laugh at themselves, and they began to be a little bit sort of postmodern and ironic in the movies. And this, I think, it slots into that as well. So I didn't really like this very much because I felt when I first watched it when I was a young lad, because I felt like it was the passing of an era. But since then it's become a bit of a classic, and it's become a bit of a talking point because we're almost at where it is. Do you know what I mean? Have you got any sort of takes on just like this movie in a wider cultural sense before we jump into it?
Well, I guess I can't say as much because it came out a couple of years before I was born. So obviously, I didn't see it in theaters, and I wouldn't have been around to see the earlier Sylvester Stallone movies like the Rockies and the Rambos when they were out. But it does feel like it, like something of the era. I know that the 1990s were full of cynicism, a lot of irony. That was really common in a lot of films around this time, and it does really feel like a 90s movie. I know Sylvester Stallone is mostly known for his work in the 70s and 80s, but then this one does feel very, very 90s. Kind of reminiscent of something like Batman Forever, or like if you contrast that with Tim Burton's first Batman movie, like the You can see that the tones are a lot less serious. The world, it looks a lot hokier, and the costumes are more ridiculous. And this movie is one that really leans into that. So, I mean, I know it's meant to be,
It's
I know that the book
yeah,
is meant to be silly.
yeah. It is camp, but it has a kind of get out because they're saying like, yeah, well, that's kind of the point. But on some of the other ones, it was sort of camp to be cute and funny and ironic, whereas this, it's kind of baked into the narrative. So let's jump in then. So I'm going to assume that most people, I mean, just by the chat, I think everybody gets the gist of Demolition Man. But I'll just briefly like kind of recap the story, the plot. So it opens in LA in 1996, which would be in a few years ahead of when this was made. This came out in 93, so it's kind of like a few years' time. LA is sort of depicted as this hellscape, this dystopia where the cops, it's just like sort of a street warfare. I mean, straight away, I thought that was odd because that's kind of just how I imagine Elliot to be now. Like, but then you've got to kind of think, well, yeah, in 1993, it actually wasn't. It didn't seem that way. Like, Terminator 2, well, Terminator 1 and 2, at least, are set in Los Angeles, and it doesn't look like the kind of, well, what it is, what we imagine it to be these days. Not that I've ever been there, like, but it was kind of like, you know, you can have the kids, you got white boys driving around on motorcycles. It still seems kind of civilized, whereas now I just imagine Los Angeles being like a complete hellscape. But nevertheless, this is it's like open warfare on the streets, and you've got Wesley Snipes is the main bad guy, this psycho, who's black, which is kind of unusual as well from this perspective, and he is a complete lunatic. But to be fair, I do think he's got good moves. I do think he comes across, like, the way he fights and the way he does those high kicks and things. I think he did other stuff like Blade. I'm not sure what training he had, actually, but he as a kind of fighter, he does come across well in this, I think. And then you've got Stallone, of course, who's you don't need to sort of go on about him in terms of being an action star. So he goes after Wesley Snipe in the prologue to the film, and Wesley Snipe's got 30 innocent civilians on a bus, and Stallone's trying to find out where they are, the hostages. He wants to get the hostages back. And it turns out that they're all they all die in the big explosion during the confrontation. Later, it turns out they were actually already dead. But the upshot of this like little plot point is that Stallone is condemned as well as Wesley Snipes, and they're both put in a sort of deep freeze cryogen thing for, I think it's like 36 years. They come out it'll be like 40 years. So they come out in 2036. Now, first, Wesley Snipes comes out, gets defrosted, and he comes out and immediately just wreaks havoc. Now, how that actually happened, how he actually got out, we'll come to later, but there was a bit of monkey business went on there. They can't control him. What we discover is that this society has become ridiculously in the 40 years between, society has completely changed, and it's become very touchy feel. Well, it's not touchy, they're not allowed to touch each other, but it's become very emotional, it's become very feminized and soft, but also like insidiously technocratic and totalitarian as well. So one of the most famous things, of course, is that if somebody swears, then there's like a little fine comes out because they've all got digital currencies and they're chipped as well. They don't have cash anymore because that would be unhygienic. And if you swear, because everybody's being surveyed all of the time, you get like a little so it's like a social credit system, basically. So then Wesley Snipes starts single-handedly cutting through all of these like soft sort of homo cops, just braying everybody, kicking the hell out of everybody. The cops turn up and nobody has guns. They've got these like little sort of taser stick things, which are pathetic. So they just can't control them. They can't do anything with them. So then Sandra Bullock, I always remember like Dennis Penis in the 90s. He just as a little tangent, me first tangent here. There used to be this fella called Dennis Penis who took the piss out of celebrities in the 90s. And he went up to Sandra Bullock at an award ceremony one time. And he said, would it be fair to call, if I put all of your films together, could I call it A Whole Lot of Bullocks? And she almost spat in his face. So this is one of Sandra Bullock's first roles. I was never a big fan of Sandra Bullock. But whatever, she's got this kind of nostalgia thing for the 90s. She loves the 90s. And she says the only way that we can deal with Simon Phoenix, he's called Wesley Snipes, is that we've got to get the other one out of deep freeze. We've got to bring back John Spartan because he's like hard as nails as well, and we're all soft and gay. So we've got to bring back John Spartan, and he can he's like man enough to take him on. So they thaw out Sylvester Stallone as well and cut him loose. So what we've got is a sort of fish out of water type setup where you've got these hard cases from the dystopian, you know, masculine, uber violent 90s are thawed out in this sort of weird great reset, touchy feely, authoritarian, libtarded future. And this is the central pitch. This is why people like this film so much. I actually think people overdo the... I noticed, like, because I do a little bit of background research and things, like, it's been well known for years that Demolition Man, like, was predicting the future, that it got a few things right. And I just think people got a bit carried away with the COVID stuff, like, saying, oh, this is literally what it was like in the pandemic, which it was. But I think it's got a bit more depth to it than that, than just to say, oh, well, this is what it was like in the lockdowns and whatnot. I think there's a lot more going on with that. So I'll pass it over to Endeavor, and then we'll go on with the rest of the plot there.
Well, yeah, I guess what struck me the most from the movie was what you mentioned. It does seem to be like the vision for the future that you're giving. It's the Davos vision for the future. So it's almost like one of those WEF promo videos, you know, the ones with the xylophone music and the text that lights up and the videos of these smiling mixed race people touching on screens or something like that. The movie kind of feels like it's set in this, or at least the after the intro, the future, according to this movie, seems to be set in this world where humans are infantilized as technology almost acts as a parent, acts as their mom, shielding them from all the unpleasantries in the world. So a few of the things that weren't allowed were they didn't eat meat. Sex was like turned into virtual. Like it didn't involve any contact anymore. Curse words were illegal. Guns didn't exist anymore. Alcohol was gone. So all of these had been erased from the human experience by this tyrannical technocratic system on the grounds that it's being done for the good of humanity. And the world that I find that the world that they've created, as in like, and I'm not talking about the movie, but the world that's presented in the movie, it's one that's really vapid and boring because humans have absolutely no agency. So, like for example, there's that assistant guy to the what is he, the president or something like that, and he just looks like he just looks extremely gay, and they even call it murder. They call it a murder, death, kill, but they said they haven't had a murder since 2010, which would have been like 20, 30 years earlier than the movie is set. It really does seem like, in some ways, it predicted not really the world of today. I'd say it more predicted the vision for the world of today that the elites have, because I can get into this a bit more later. I don't think Demolition Man shows our world today. What I think it shows is the world that our elites want today and that they think they will create. But as we can get into it, and it actually kind of plays into the movie as well. There's a reason that won't actually come about, and it's similar to how this kind of world starts to fall apart in the movie Demolition Man. So it's this worldview that's based on this calculated, purely materialistic, utilitarian worldview, and it relies on the ever presence of technology to basically coddle humanity like they're a bunch of children. And the world that's shown, it's quite boring and depressing because there's no consideration given to anything transcendent. So the life would really just be unfulfilling. And it's pretty reflective of the Davos class today.
Yeah, I mean, so as the plot sort of goes on, we discover a few other things. So I'll pick up on where I was, because I think sometimes like it's worth drilling down into exactly what the plot is, because I think Demolition Man, it's a smart movie that presents itself as a dumb movie. So you're kind of like, you look at it and you look at the campy uniforms, you look at some of the dodgy dialogue, and you think that this is a really dumb movie. But then you kind of understand that it's got a bit more going on in the storyline and in the plot and everything like that. And one of the things that we learn is that the president, if you like, the big brother character played by Nigel Hawthorne, he actually owns a giant corporation called Cocteau Industries in the French sort of speaking of it. And it was he who arranged for Wesley Snipes to come out of the deep freeze. And while he was in there as well, they've updated him. So when they're in the deep freeze, they're actually having their brains manipulated. They don't touch on this much, but so there's one part where Sylvester Stallone has he's learned how to knit to calm him down, to kind of get him, what is it, embrace his calm, as they put it. But Wesley Snipes, they've sent him the other way. So Wesley Snipes has, he's actually become more of a skilled killer. He's actually become more of, he knows more about the security apparatus and how to hack things. So what's happened is that the sort of the big brother Cocteau fella, he has arranged for all of this to happen, which leads to the next question of why. And the reason for that is that he wants them to assassinate somebody called, I think it's called something friendly, but it's Dennis Leary plays him. So what you've got is living down in the sewers is a kind of resistance movement to who they are the ones who are in rebellion. They are the free thinking people who are in revolt. They're locked out of the system. They call them the scraps. And this is what Cocteau sort of views as the biggest threat. He doesn't actually view Wesley Snipes as much of a threat. He views these kind of rebellious types, these revolutionaries, as the main threat. So he wants Wesley Snipes to neutralize Dennis Leary, neutralize the revolution, if you like. So it's interesting to look at it from the power perspective, sort of. What if you wanted to go all kind of elite theory on it? He views Dennis Leary as representing a rival castle, which has to be neutralized. You know.
So just to remind me, because again, I've only seen the movie the one time. Dennis Leary, he was the leader of like the rabble of the underworld, right?
Yeah, yeah, they're called the scraps, and these, they have to live on rats. They're not, you know, they're really outcasts. They don't have any access to the system and all of this kind of thing. And you see them in, there's a scene where Stallone meets Cocteau and they go to Taco Bell, which is like there's been these franchise wars, and for some reason Taco Bell come out on top. So they've got a monopoly on all of the it's an American thing. I think it's kind of Mexican food.
I know what Taco Bell is, but wasn't it Pizza Hut in the movie?
No, it wasn't. It was Taco Bell. Okay. It's famous, like the we're going for Taco Bell is like a famous sort of trope in the movie, which is kind of weird for me because I'm not that familiar with Taco Bell, as an Englishman.
It's horrible, by the way. It's just an side note.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But it adds a little bit more to it, because which is funny for the 90s, actually. Because what it says is that the corporations and these franchises have had their own war, and all of this took place with the foundational event was a giant earthquake, which they called the big one. Most of these kinds of sort of dystopian sort of depictions of the future, they've usually got like a founding event, like something huge and cataclysmic has happened, and then they've had to sort of pick up the pieces afterwards and do the best they can. But usually it's kind of hard dystopian. You know, we discussed it with the Mad Max, where it's just complete civilization erasure. Well, then you've also got the Blade Runner types. This one's a little bit different because everything's completely functional. In fact, everything's much more advanced than what it was beforehand. But what you get into is different questions about the human condition and these kinds of things.
So I think that there's an interesting contrast between the underworld. I'm just going to call it the underworld. I don't know if it actually has a name. And then the world on top. Because I feel that, like what I said earlier, is that the world on the surface is kind of like what the Davos class want to create. This is what they envision as the future. It's kind of like the Jetsons. Remember the Jetsons, that cartoon, the Jetsons? It's like kind of like the Flintstones, but set in the future. But the Jetsons actually kind of, the world in the Jetsons actually kind of looks decent because it has the social values of 1960s America, and you know, the family values, and you know, everyone in the Jetsons is white, and it even has like a 1950s futurist aesthetic kind of. So the world there kind of looks a bit looks a bit appealing, but then the world in this one, it just looks it looks hokey, effeminized. The people are really infantilized, and it really just looks depressing because of how little agency the humans actually have. And then I'd say that the underworld is more of the reality of what is more representative of the reality of the world that I think that the current crop of elites really are pushing us towards. And it's because, they have this vision, or at least a certain portion of them, let's say that the Davos crew, they have this vision of this technocratic future where technology has brought an end to human want and need. It's been brought about equality, and we can all share equally in the comforts which technology has to offer. But the problem is that baked into their cake is the ideologies of like egalitarianism, and it's these denial of human nature is just baked into it, and the actual result is going to be a lot. The actual result of the world that they're creating, it's going to be a lot more similar to the underworld, where all the rebels or the resistance, the dirty folks who are living in squalor underneath the pristine, technocratic, prosperous society on top. I think that's a lot more like. I think that that's actually a lot more likely of a future than that kind of technocratic grid that they show, because the problem is that a lot of the assumptions that are going into that vision are incorrect, and they're we can see in real time that those are bringing about the underworld and not the world above.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to point out that when this was made, nobody was talking about Davos or the Great Reset or anything like that. This actually goes back further. Like, Sandra Bullock's name in this is Lenina Huxley, which is a direct reference to Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which this is a kind of softer version. This is a less extreme version of Brave New World. But there's a lot of the elements there. Like you have to have a license to get pregnant. Basically, they've already started having kids via test tubes, which is a Brave New World thing. In Brave New World, they do touch each other. All they ever do is have sex, but and get high on Soma. So everybody's doped up all of the time, which they haven't. The sex in this is where they wear those weird headset things, so it's just this sort of purely kind of sensational manipulation of the brain rather than actually having physical contact with people, which they in this world they view that as being like disgusting and horrible. And another similarity with, whereas in Brave New World, it's encouraged that that's all people do. Like the fact that they can be like completely hedonistic is your freedom. That's how your freedom will express itself, which I think is more close to our world than to Demolition Man, actually, where it's actively encouraged to be a degenerate. And then that will be the freedom that you have. Whereas in Demolition Man, they don't even have that. It's just wear these kind of stupid headset things and get a sort of simulation of it. Again, though, I mean, you know, when you're talking about like everybody being obsessed with porn and all this kind of thing. It's on a similar line there, I suppose.
I mean, it's going in that direction because, you know, you look at the younger generations and they're, you know, the vision of sex from the 90s. And again, I wasn't around for this, but you had this idea that like, it was just like going wild and sleeping around and hookup culture and, you know, the frat boys and all that stuff. And that stuff's quickly disappearing. Like for the Zoomers, like I think like a huge amount of them, like something about like 30 or 40% of them are still virgins. I don't know the exact statistics, but I know that like the actual amount of sex that people are having these days has gone way down. And then you see something like things like porn that are stepping in to replace that.
But where I think there's some kind of overlap between Brave New World and Demolition Man and our real world. I mean, I see Woodlanders in the chat. Like, you're gonna end up with what you were saying, where most of the people will just live outside of like the grid, you know, outside of this sort of digitized surveillance system. I actually don't think so. I think most people will opt in and just live with the misery. But you will always have people on the outside of it. And in Brave New World, that's the case as well, where I think the main character wanders off to discover, because there's like these badlands where people live, and it's all savagery. So they're kind of these old primitive types, a lot more primitive than what Sylvester Stallone is relative to the rest of the movie. In the original script, I think they were going to have it like hundreds of years difference, but they opted just for 40, and you could have a little bit more continuity between the 90s and like 2036 or whatever. But you're still going to have people who have opted, you know, are out somewhere quietly raising chickens and hoping that they're going to get left alone and this kind of thing. Whereas in this, because it's in what they call San Angeles, then for reasons of the making the actual storyline, they've just opted to have the outsiders down in the sewers with their own, you know, with like struggling and being dirty and eating rats, but like being free. And I think in the end, most people would opt just not to have the freedom, to be honest. And I think there you get a lot of the sort of 90s sort of mentality in it with Dennis Leary himself. But just to get back to the storyline, and what we discover is that Wesley Snipes is essentially this chaotic character who's been allowed to run riot and kill left, right, and center in order to take care of this problem of the resistance movement down in the sewers. And this is where Sylvester Stallone begins to question like the Big Brother Cocteau guy and his association with this. And so you begin to understand that actually it is just all his creation as a kind of megalomaniac. And he even says, like, what was I supposed to do? So you get this kind of, it's put forward that, yes, the world was pretty much on its knees, and I created a system where, like, he does say, like, without me, everybody would just be scratching around in the dirt. I brought civilization back. I gave people a sense of purpose. I gave people order and told them how to live, which is what they always wanted. I mean, he's got a fair point, hasn't he? And what's weird about it is that when you see, when you get introduced to Dennis Leary, for the younger types, you know, in the 90s, Dennis Leary was huge, and his career just seemed to die a death in the 2000s. And what he would do, I think he was Canadian, maybe, I don't know, but he would speak really quickly, and he'd swear a lot. And he had this really abrasive, comedic kind of persona that he did. And he'd always be like smoking a cigarette, smoke like he'd be chain smoking cigarettes. And he was always going on about like, his routine would be like, I don't want people telling me how dangerous like cigarettes are. Like, I want to smoke cigarettes until I can't wait till I get that cancer. I can feel that tumor in my throat. And it was all of this kind of degenerate Gen X sort of nihilistic humor. But the point was that it was all based on personal freedom. And that's why they've made him this character in this movie, because he is coded in this way of extreme sort of libertine rebelliousness against any kind of constraints at all. So what you've got is this, like, two extremes. You've got, like, the authoritarian kind of feminized gay world that they've created. But then you've also got the juxtaposition of a quintessentially Gen X sort of, you know, classic liberal. I want my freedom. Like, I want to have a rack of lab. I want to have a rack of ribs so big, so smothered in gravy sauce and mayonnaise, like it gives us a heart attack. I want to paint myself green and run down the street naked, and then at the end. There's some of the action sequences in this, like, really drag on, I think. But then at the end, the Wesley Snipes kills Cocteau, which is fitting because it's kind of like his out of control chaos Frankenstein monster has now returned to the person who created him in the first place and killed him. And then Stallone takes out Wesley Snipes himself. And so then the kind of the way they round it all up is with this, like, what are we going to do now? And they have this sort of back and forth. And there's not really, somebody in the chat mentioned it as well, there's not really any way, they don't really know what the way forward is. Because one of them says they want to just have complete anarchy. And that's kind of, Dennis Leary says, let's just get drunk and literally paint the town. Let's have, like, graffiti everywhere and just do whatever we want. And Stallone sort of steps in and says, well, look, let's loosen up a bit and you get yourself cleaned up a bit. And then, you know, we'll negotiate it and we'll kind of figure it out. And I just thought, you won't. Actually, you're just going to create the situation where you need an authoritarian to come in and lay down the law once again, which is exactly what will happen. And in the course of sort of history since the 90s, that actually is what happened. That sort of vacuum was filled with what today people would call woke or earlier political correctness. Like, that absence of any foundational values created a vacuum which was going to be filled with something, and it was filled with something which was dystopian that you see in Demolition Man, which is why it resonates so much with people now.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, say, around 2017, 2018, times of, like, you know, the migrant crisis and the things that followed that. And so I'm talking like the pre-COVID times. I remember that the vision most of us had for the future, of, like, imagining what the future would look like. It was that kind of favela world that there's going to be this, the importation of the third world into the West is going to turn the West into the third world. So they're saying, well, is America going to become like Brazil, where there's just violent crime everywhere, extremely low trust, and the quality of life drops drastically. And then when COVID came around, I think that the conversation kind of changed towards looking at the vision, the Davos vision of the future. So the technocratic grid where everyone has a digital ID, they have chips in their hand, and they need to get 10 different injections just to walk outside their home. This was kind of like this competing vision. Like, I remember a few of us were even discussing what would actually be worse. What would be worse? The favela world, like living in a third world like country, like that looks like Brazil, where you're surrounded by a bunch of people who you don't identify with. They're extremely violent. There's very little wealth. The amenities don't work. but at least you have the state off your back. At least you're not like going around with your digital ID, and you don't have to get 10 injections just to have a job or something like that. And then the other one is, well, on the other hand, it's the Davos one, but well, you have to put up with all of this bureaucratic nightmare. You got to get all of these accounts. You have to check all of these boxes just to go on. If you just want to go on a vacation to the country next to you, well, you got to check like 10 of these boxes. Are you up to date on your injections? Do you have a good enough social credit score? It was kind of these competing visions that like which one is worse. I think though that what we're gonna get is probably something similar to both of them. I think that what we're headed for is the worst of both worlds, where the elite class are trying to implement the Davos WEF vision of the future. So like the above world in Demolition Man, you got the elite class trying to implement that, whereas the situation is starting to become a lot more like the underworld. So the phrase we have is like is anarcho-tyranny, that if you're a normal, well-adjusted, middle-class white person, then in order to start your own business, buy a house, travel to another country or something, there are all these hoops that you need to jump through. Whereas if it's just some third world migrant, they just walk across the border and they're given free housing and everything like that. So I feel that what we're kind of headed towards is the worst of both worlds, that you have the dirt, the grime, the violence of the below world in Demolition Man, but then you have the bureaucracy, the infantilization, the frustration, the dehumanizing effect of the upper world. I feel like that's probably what we're actually headed towards.
Yeah, I do. Your thing is, like I say, you don't even have to sort of draw comparisons to the lockdown times, because the purpose of the law, usually the purpose of the law was to ensure like your rights. You've got a certain set of rights. Or actually there's something specific to that set down when you're breaking the law. And what we find is that in this more kind of therapeutic state that we have, and what's in Demolition Man, is that the rules and the law it's not even so much law, but I'll come back to that in a moment. But what it is monitoring your behavior. All you've got to do is look at the hate speech laws, which are coming in all over the place now. So if you look at something like Scotland, where there's all this discussion being going on over the last week or so about how draconian the hate speech stuff is, which I think it's moronic. I think a lot of these countries are trying to do these things and they don't know how to do them right. Like, I'll leave that take one side for a moment. I think it's amateur night. I don't think they're smart enough. And what's happened in the Scottish situation is that they're now complaining like that neo-Nazis have swamped the system with fallacious reporting of like to hate speech accounts to try and jam it up and break it all apart. But the point of it is, if you get back to it, what it's there to do is to curtail speech in a way which is exactly like that little machine which spits out a fine or a ticket on the wall in Demolition Man. And it's like you've said something which is impolite. I mean, another thing to touch, which is related to this, is in Demolition Man itself, is that when in 1993, it's kind of like that was just when political correctness was starting to, people were starting to speak about it a bit. People were starting to notice this. And the original framing wasn't, like, this is obviously like 30-odd years ago now. And it wasn't as explicitly vicious or dangerous or totalitarian as it is now. It's over the years, it's become more blatant. But back in the early 90s, I mean, in America, and then it came into Britain mainly with Tony Blair. But it's one of those things where it was just dribbling slowly but surely, dribbling out of the institutions. And in around when Demolition Man would have came out, or a few years before that, it was mainly this kind of sort of, it was seen as being polite. It was this way. Well, we're going to be in going forward. There's going to be these do's and don'ts, and people will say, "Oh, you can't say that. You can't say that." Or they'd look at you the wrong way, as if we that's just impolite. That's just not a very nice way of saying something, and it would be back then quite an egregious racial slur that they'd be monitoring. But the point is, like, originally, it kind of crept its way in. And you'll still see leftists say this today. You'll still see them try and sort of disown the fact that it is like a hegemonic ideology, which nobody is allowed to question. And they will say, like, look, it's just about being nice. It's just about being nice to each other. And back in the early 90s, that was kind of how people thought. People thought everything was getting a little bit soft and a little bit touchy-feely. And of course, then you'll see that sort of the Sylvester Stallone is chosen here because he's like a man out of time. He doesn't know how to go along with the speech codes and these kind of soft liberal mores, which are becoming normalized. So they've kind of dropped him in there. But it's also just like being somebody in your 40s and just living in the 2020s, to be honest. You just can't keep up with it all. And gradually, slowly but surely, over the decades, there was one claw after another came out of political correctness, until now you can just see that it's something completely psychotic. But from the perspective of the 1990s, the early 1990s, it was this questioning of where this was going, where you had to watch yourself, you had to be nice, everybody had to be wrapped up in cotton wool. You know, this is the way that the millennials were tracked and all of this kind of thing. Whereas somebody like Dennis Leary is the complete opposite. He's deliberately offensive.
Well, it's interesting. I really like that little part of the movie that they have these audio recorders everywhere recording your speech. And if you utter a curse word, you're gonna have to pay a fine. So, I mean, part of that is surveillance. So not only because that also would have been new in the 1990s as well. We're really used to today with social media and with smartphones. We're used to being surveyed constantly. So I know, again, I came of age in the 2010s, but I do remember people saying that, like, before social media existed, you could get away with a lot more. Where something like in the day of smartphones and social media, one moment can ruin your entire reputation if somebody gets it on camera and posts it online. I think that with the fines that they have to pay for using curse words, it's so analogous to the idea of hate speech laws today. And then also not even just the hate speech laws, because I mean, these are the extreme end of that, but let's not forget that there is also this massive low level enforcement of wokeness, if that's what we want to call it, political correctness, that you might not be sent to jail for saying something politically incorrect, but know well that there are people out there and they're being encouraged to do this. But the morality that's preached today is that you're a good person if you try to ruin the reputation of somebody who says something politically incorrect. So, you know, somebody on social posts something on social media that they don't like, they say that the person considers racist. Well, then you're a good person if you go to their employer and report them and say, "Are you aware that this racist is working for you?" You know, we are used to now this entire culture where you're walking on eggshells and everyone's just terrified of breaking the dominant morality of wokeness, because even though I don't think people are that afraid of going to prison per se, they know that there's going to be hell to pay via these attacks on their career by coming from groups like the Anti-Defamation League or Hope Not Hate. And then even below that, it's the risk of social ostracization, of having a bunch of people call you a racist and say you're a horrible person and go around saying that everyone shouldn't be friends with you. But I think, though, that what the film captures with this is that I think everyone would agree that it would just be a horrible idea to have this thing that fines people for using curse words. Now, I'm not someone who goes around using curse words constantly. I'm not against it, but it's something I try to keep under control. But what is the purpose of a curse word? It's an expression. It's a way of letting out your aggression in a situation in which you're angry. And is anger a good human emotion? Well, no. Nobody likes being angry, but it's just a natural human emotion. And we wouldn't be human if there was nothing which made us angry. And the idea of like fining people for using curse words, it's outlawing a natural human emotion. And that's exactly what hate speech laws are as well. Now, I do think that they stretch the meaning of what they call hate. You know, like even just pointing out crime statistics, which their own government agencies verify, even pointing that out on social media can get you called a so-called hater, even though you might not actually have any hate in your heart. You just point out that truth. That's what's called hate today. But even and of course, you know, hate is everyone associates that as being a negative human emotion. But again, it is just a normal human emotion that a dislike. And it's not even like hate speech. It's just dislike. Is it wrong to dislike someone? So, you know, you have all these. And I know that it's also something which, you know, on a personal level, you're allowed to dislike someone. But it's more it comes along with the group dynamic. So it comes along with. Or do you dislike this protected group? But again, I'm not going to say that I encourage people to just be this raging hate monger. But I just think that disliking somebody, and even if that includes like even if that may include a group at some point, that's not an unnatural thing. I mean, like let's just say like if I don't know. I guess I don't know if I should pick one particular group, but you know, let's say that your government imports a bunch of them and they cause a bunch of violent crime and they soak up a bunch of welfare payments or something. They soak up a bunch of welfare money. They have this entitled attitude where they say that you're an oppressor, you're white privilege and you owe us a bunch of stuff. Well, I mean, is it not natural for you to dislike that? Is that not the natural human reaction? And that is why things like hate speech laws are so totalitarian and just so dystopian. It's because they're outlawing what is just a normal human emotion. And it's mostly politicized because now, let's be honest, they're not going to outlaw hatred of people of white people because, you know, that guy, Hamza Youssef, it was funny that a lot of people were reporting him for hate speech because he gave that horrible speech several years ago where everyone probably knows the one I'm referring to where he says the minister of this white, this judge white, and he just says the word white with such like hate and vitriol in his voice. Now we all know that he's not going to be the one who goes to prison for uttering hate speech, but it's politicized. However, what's so frightening about it is not only that it's politically totalitarian, that it's banning certain ideas, but that it's even trying to like get you to reorient your emotions, to tell you that you can't have this normal human reaction to a situation like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is worth reading out a quote by C.S. Lewis, which is quite famous on this. Because it relates directly to, it's on his essay in God in the Dock, Essays on Theology, Making of Modern Theology. And he says, quote, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It would be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep. His cupidity may at some point be satiated. But those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. They may be more likely to go to heaven, yet at the same time likelier to make a hell of earth. This very kindness stings with intolerable insult. To be cured against one's will and cured of states which we may not regard as disease is to be put on a level of those who have not yet reached the age of reason or those who never will, to be classed with infants, imbeciles, and domestic animals, end quote. I mean, that's just fantastic. That's just an absolutely wonderful, I think that sums it all up. Because what's happening is, in our world and in the world of Demolition Man, is that essentially, I mean, in Demolition Man, the language they use is infantile and childish and stupid. That's actually why we think of it as being kind of comedic, and but also a horror show at the same time. And it's because you've got grown adults talking about finding their emotional calm, and all of it kind of stinks of this over, like, omnipotent therapeutic sort of state of where everybody's care, everybody's thoughts are always being nudged and winked in a certain way for maximum happiness outcomes. And this is exactly the same with the hate speech stuff as well. It's because it'll seep into people's thoughts. And in terms of the hate speech laws, I think the people, let's say in Glasgow, or on a like white working class people in Glasgow or Edinburgh or wherever, across Scotland, in council estates and in flat terraces and whatnot, like they will have a specific way of talking to each other, which will just come natural. It's just the way they are. And all of these laws seem specifically designed to just kind of cripple them, so that fundamentally they just can't express themselves in a way that they have, or like, which comes natural to them, which is part of their culture. So then it's okay if you're some kind of libtard to say, well, you know, just be nice. But what you're really talking about is fundamental, like a really deep, profound social engineering in the way that people think and speak. Like that's what's at the root of it all. And then to go back to more to Demolition Man as well, is that you can say, well, if you are going to outlaw hate, why don't you just outlaw sadness and bad moods? And in Demolition Man, that's pretty much what they've done. You can go, they go to the computers in Demolition Man, you can stand in front of a screen, and like the AI will tell you, like, you look wonderful today, and look at the weather, sunny, and you, I'm really getting like a positive vibe from you today. And the computer will kind of make you feel nice about yourself, and then send you on your way as it sort of transfers the digital credits or whatever this kind of thing. And it's like C.S. Lewis says, and it's because they're doing it for positive reasons, that there's no end to it, because they can sleep well at night thinking, well, it's for the good, it's a positive thing that I'm doing. And what it really is kind of shoving a pillow and suffocating all independent thought under this, which is kind of like, you know, that goes a little bit back to the COVID thing. But these things, these tendencies have been around for a long time, you know, like Brave New World, which was like alluded to in this. But I would say C.S. Lewis's quote, where when it's these moral busybodies doing things for the betterment, doing things for your own good, they'll never rest, because they are not, then it's not like they're kind of sadists outside of a gulag who are just evil. They think they're doing the right thing. And that's actually what Demolition Man does very well. Everybody's happy in Demolition Man. You can't really say, well, except for the people in the scraps, the Dennis Leary, the resistance. But you can't really say that they are oppressed. They've kind of got on with it. They're kind of, there's one or two people, Sandra Bullock has her doubts. But by and large, they've learned to live with it. They've kind of just given into it, and they'll be prodded and finding their, what is it, finding their calm and finding their inner islands and thinking of waterfalls and positive thoughts forever, and all under the watchful eyes of the billionaire corporate manager who made all of this thing happen.
Yeah, and it's the way that they determine what is good for you. So, yeah, I hadn't heard that C.S. Lewis quote before, but I did get the same feeling from the movie that it's kind of this tyranny that's supposedly for your own good. The morality that it's based on is this kind of utilitarian this utilitarian materialism, one that treats people as if they're these numbers on a spreadsheet and they're going to calculate what's the optimal way of life for you based on all of this mass data that they have available, which does this sound familiar to anyone? So like a few of the things that they have in the movie, there's that scene where Sandra Bullock says that in the present day, they have sex using these visual headsets because exchanging of bodily fluids is, it causes illnesses and stuff like that. And again, what does this remind you of? Does this remind you of the pandemic? Because how many times were we told over those 2.5 years that, you can't go to your grandma's funeral because, the numbers on the graph are going to go up by 0.3% if we allow public gatherings of 15 or more people. So, you can't do it. The algorithm shows this, and it's for your own good. The problem is that this entire way of looking at the world, it doesn't take into account anything transcendental. So the optimal way of life, according to such technocratic systems, like in Demolition Man, and like the system which we have in place today, the optimal way of life can be calculated by putting numbers into a bunch of algorithms. But that's really not how the human soul works. We want the pursuit of the transcendental. We want to work towards something that's not material, that's something that actually that gives us fulfillment. And that stuff's just totally written out of any of these kind of technocratic systems, whereas like all of your agency is taken away. Everyone has good memories from childhood, but nobody wants to be a child forever. Maybe some millennials who still like Harry Potter do, but that's neither here nor there. When you are a child, what do children hate the most? The children hate the most being treated like a kid who's younger, like being younger than they actually are. Every kid is chomping at the bit to gain more agency, whether it's that he can now, when he turns 16 and he can now drive a car, when he turns 12 years old and he's allowed to stay home alone when his mom goes out, when he turns 10 and his mom lets him go to the park with his friends without her watching over him. This for young children, this is them like gaining more agency, and this is something which they value instinctually because they want this, and that's just normal for humans as well. But systems like this, they rob you of that agency, and they revert you to the childlike state, almost like a mother looking after a baby. Now, there's nothing wrong with a mother looking after a baby. It's again, it's a perfectly natural thing to do. But the problem is, the mother shouldn't still be treating the baby like he's 3 years old when he's 30. But the problem is with these systems is that they treat you as if you're an infant, your entire life.
Well, yeah. Let's just flip it then. And let's say you had this same kind of social credit system in place, but it was right wing. So all of the incentives would be skewered to sort of have our ideals. The outcomes would favor a homogenous society, happy children, females would be females, males would be males, and all of this kind of thing. If you could rejigger the algorithm and have all of those outcomes, would then you support it or still not?
Well, no, I wouldn't. And I don't even think it would be necessary because, at least in my opinion, things like men being men and women being women, you don't need a social credit system to bring that about. That's just going to happen naturally if you just leave people alone and let them live. There isn't going to be transgenderism. Like you look at something like well, any time period in history prior to the last like couple of decades. Could transgenderism ever have existed? Could that have existed out in the American West? Well, there's no way. You didn't need a social credit system to get Europeans to be ethnocentric before 1960. They just did it naturally. You didn't need a social credit system to get men to be men. They just did it naturally. So I don't even think that. I just think that a system which is more a system and a worldview which is more in line with the natural order would not require any kind of social credit system. I think that this stuff has to be brought in when it's something unnatural which you're trying to bring about.
Yeah, I think the existence of all of these overarching systems actually is the problem. That is the problem in itself. I mean, one of the things that I've kind of touched on is the idea that the designer of this was like a corporate magnate, which I think is interesting because, you know, we were talking about the hate speech laws. That's actually written into law. But when you're surrounded and completely depending on all of these corporations, they can bypass the law entirely and just have it written into terms and services. And it may be more of a threat because you've got no comebacks. So if your iPhone, instead, you know how they've got that little machine which spits the fines, the sticker, the little tickets out to say that you've just had like done a wrong word, you've just used bad language. I mean, imagine if your iPhone started doing that. And you couldn't get rid of it because it was also your digital ID, and you got all of your bank details on it, and your stuff is on it. And when you say, well, this isn't right, how can this happen? And it's like, well, it's written into the terms and conditions, which everybody just browses straight past. I mean, it sounds paranoid, but I'm convinced my iPhone listens to me. I think iPhones are listening to what we say.
They do. That's not paranoia. They actually do. They will actually listen to what you say and then send you advertisements based on the words that you've uttered.
Yeah. So if you're talking about like where we are now, I mean. Against the term and conditions, I mean, of all these corporate, you've got no comebacks at all. But you've got no comebacks against the terms and conditions of a bank. And yet all of them are moving into the area of modifying your behavior and creating incentives where you have a certain sort of personality type. You have certain opinions about things. And this can all be done when you're completely surrounded by all of this technology and all of these corporations who run everything. You hardly even need to bring the law into it. The law is just a big sledgehammer. But all of these other little nudges and nips and tucks are just surrounded us so much so. I mean, I remember those paranoia about mobile phones and the old Nokias. And people then were saying, what happens if it's going to follow me about? Like, can I be tracked by this? And everybody was like, no, of course you can't be tracked by it. But it was a big scare. It was like, where is this going? And now we've entered the stage where it's like, oh, yeah, your iPhone listens to you and then sends you messages by saying, like, but you know what I mean? There's this the facial recognition technology. People get arrested in London for covering their faces up as they go by these cameras on the streets now. And it's like, no, you can't do that. You've got to show your face. You know, if you put a scarf over your mouth and your nose and whatnot, and there's a couple of people had fines for that. You know, you've got to show your face. So in this weird kind of, again, this it isn't just the state. That's the problem here. When it's just the state, I think you get this kind of 1984 kind of sledgehammer sort of, you know, everything's just raw and dirty and industrial, and but when it's all of these corporations, that's when you get the kind of gay dystopia, which is a bit gentler but more insidious because it's wriggling in its way. All of these diversity ads, which are bombarded with day in, day out, everywhere you look, it's all kind of molding your psychology. It's all insidiously crawling into your neural networks of your brain so much that you. Like when this came out, it would have been unthinkable the way we live now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, one thing you mentioned there with this, you said that people used to have this paranoia with their old Nokia phones following them around, but then today, like, we just kind of accept it. There's this case from a century ago that there was this bootlegger called Roy Olmsted in the United States in the 1920s. So a guy who sold liquor during the time of Prohibition. And one of the methods that they used to convict him was what was called wiretapping. This was and it was a brand new thing at the time. They were listening in on his phone calls. But this was seen as this huge scandal. So he even appealed this and had to go all the way up to the United States Supreme Court for them to say whether this was legal or not, for the authorities to listen in on a single phone call. And it's just incredible when you think that the thought of the authorities listening on one phone call was seen as extremely controversial 100 years ago. Today they're listening on every single phone call, whether someone is suspected of having committed a crime or not.
I'll because I see people in the chat talking about it. I know we're going off a little bit from the movie, yeah. But we always do, to be honest.
Yeah.
What happened with me, right? I was trying to sort out. I wanted a jet wash to spray some crap out the gutters, clean the walls and things. And I was trying to hook together all kinds of different hose pipes and whatnot to get what I wanted, faffing about like that. And my dad came down and he was like, "Try this one out." And it was all these, like, I don't know what you call them, like these socket things that hook into taps. And I was trying to get myself what could withstand quite high pressure. And Mrs. Morgoth rang up and she asked how I was getting on. So I was on the phone, kind of ranting down the phone that I cannot make anything fit. And then she was like, "Well, if you go here and there and you might be able to get one, you need to ring this." And it was all just this domestic kind of non-story. It doesn't matter. I was faffing about trying to get connections to make a high pressure water thing to clean the pavement, and that was it. So we had a phone call about it, and then I went on Zitter like a few hours later, and I scrolled, and all of the adverts were for like jet washes and high pressure water hoses and this kind of thing, and I was like, "Well, how does that? Is this just a coincidence?" Because I just couldn't explain it, or it was. I didn't actually search online either, and even if I did, but it was mainly just a telephone call. And I just thought, isn't this weird? Like, well, I have a private telephone call where I'm trying to do like normal boring stuff, domestic stuff. And then, like, Elon Musk's Twitter is like telling me, "Oh, well, you got to ring this thing up to get this high pressure water connection thing." And I just thought this is not right, man.
I mean, to get back to the movie a bit, something else. So we talked about how they have this technocratic system, this all controlling grid. I think that another theme in this movie, which is also something we're seeing in our world today, is the fragility of highly complex systems. So they have this extremely complex high-tech system monitoring everybody, controlling everyone's life in Demolition Man. But then all it takes is the president or whatever he was defrosting Wesley Snipes and then letting him loose. And then he's able to bring the entire system to its knees. When you think of like an example of this from the present day is that if one little problem gets into the systems we have, which are now just becoming more and more complex, it causes a lot more damage than it would under a much simpler system. So for example, today, if you're without the internet, you're basically screwed. There's almost nothing you can do. I mean, I wonder if can stores even charge you for anything anymore without the internet? I think they still can, but who knows how long that's going to last. I know that 20 years ago, if the power went out, the electricity, you could still go to the store and buy milk and buy eggs and flour, no problem. Just use cash. But these days, I mean, well, let's say that they get rid of cash, and let's say that you have this digital ID and you have to scan this QR code and it's all connected to the internet. Well, you don't even need electricity to go out. All that has to happen is just the internet connection to go out. And now the stores can't sell you your groceries because the system which they've built is based on these like ever increasingly complex systems, which once there's one small problem with them, the entire thing comes crashing down. And the other thing is like, it is, I mean, I don't know if they'd be able to get away with it today, but it is actually kind of fitting that Wesley Snipes is a black guy, and that's what they have. And then he's the one that they put into this this extremely high trust technocratic society.
All right. Let's go easy. We're on my YouTube channel.
Okay. I'll leave that there then. But anyway, I did want to bring up the case of Sweden because the movie did remind me of the country Sweden. I think both of us would agree that we would not want to live under the system that is shown in the upper world in Demolition Man. But let's just say for argument's sake, it is a high-tech, prosperous, high-trust, and for what well-run for what it does. The purpose of it might be soulless, but at least it's actually at least it shows in the film that it's actually quite well-run. You can look at it kind of like a first world country, like a white country. And a good example of this would be Sweden, because in prior decades, Sweden was almost an entirely homogenous country and had extremely high social trust. And the Swedes were able to build what was considered the best quality of life in the world in terms of wealth, safety, development. I mean, you could still make the arguments about the culture going the same way as the rest of the Western world, but at least materially, Sweden was considered to be one of the best countries in the world. But then just with the introduction of, let's just say, outsiders, Sweden is, while still not as bad as other countries in the Western world, it's quickly gaining a reputation for being a reputation for the amount of violent crime that's being committed by the migrant populations who now live there. And I think that with Sweden, like it's just something that it reminds me of, it just makes me think of naivety that they were able to create this top-notch world-class standard of living, but then it's kind of their own like naivety and belief in kind of this egalitarian universalism that's what made them give it away. Now, I know in Demolition Man, it's not exactly that, but it does go to show that you have this high trust society, this well-run society, even though this in the one in the movie, I wouldn't want to actually live in one like that. But with the introduction of chaos, it falls apart very quickly.
Yeah, because it's based on the assumption that if you take, like, say, Sweden in the 1980s, say, where it would have, you could argue that some of those Scotland, because currently, like in Britain, we had a lot of problems in the 80s. But if you take somewhere like Norway or Sweden in the 1980s, you could argue that that was about as peaceful and content a society that had ever existed in all of your human history. For those few decades, it had kind of got there. And you could say, like, and I think you used to hear about their economic model, that they were such nice countries because it was the economic model. And so I think people, leaving aside, like, you can say, well, it was inherently, it's all done on purpose to wreck the society, you know. But you can also think, well, maybe it was that they saw things in terms of systems. So if you like a kind of leftist way of looking at this would be where the actual sort of human biomass is not really very important. What is important is the system. So in their case, they got the system right. Therefore, it shouldn't really matter what humans go into it. Of course, it's completely backwards. It was the human capital that produced those societies that made it that way. They were the ones that made that society work in such a way. You like if Sweden switched from being this kind of social democratic big state welfare nets and all of this and switched to like libertarianism, it would have still been a wonderful place because of the people. It really wouldn't have mattered that much. Because they would have, for example, yeah, you had welfare states, but because of the kind of the social trust, it would have been seen as taboo to lounge around on the dole while everybody else was paying for you. So it's because there would have been social pressure not to let the team down. I remember that in England. And that would have been much less than what it was like in those countries. Whereas if you lost your job and you went through a bit of a hard time, it was there to catch you till you got back on your feet. All of these little things are built into the society, in a high trust society. The system, and it wasn't the system that was great, it was the people. And this is what they fun, even if, I mean, and I'm here, I'm being as generous, like this is a steel man of that position. I'm being as generous as I possibly can towards the motivations of a multicultural society. You could say it was just inherently there to destroy those populations, to fundamentally form some kind of disgusting revolution in those places. If you wanted to be as kind as possible, you could say, well, it was actually because they had these systems in place and people assumed that it wouldn't really matter what people went and lived in those systems. It was the systems that were good, the people, material conditions and all the rest of it. That didn't matter. And it was, it's just fundamentally flawed. And so in something like Demolition Man, you can kind of see it as well, where they're trying to replicate, they're trying to transition from being a kind of, you know, Los Angeles when it was chaos and it was horror, into a high trust sort of Scandinavian society. But because the human capital isn't the same and the setting isn't the same and the culture isn't the same, they've got to kind of have this authoritarian police state to bring it all about, which then sort of takes away the utopian aspect to it because it's forced top down.
Yeah, I mean, it's also important to note, some people posted in the chat that Sweden had I think this is safe for YouTube, Sweden did have a eugenics program which went on for decades, up until I think it was the 1970s even, that this was still going on. So, I mean, when we want to talk about the human capital, I mean, a lot of work had gone into that. It's not like you can just take that system and then supplant and plant it in some third world country and you're going to get the same results. But yeah, you're right though, that I remember even in the 2000s and even in the 2010s, you'd hear these commentators, and this is when I was just getting interested in politics, say around like 2013, they were talking about the Nordic model, and you'd get these American shitlibs talking about the Nordic model, the model of society they have in Scandinavia, and how, well, they have the highest quality of life there, so we need to model ours. And I mean, there's something that they're forgetting. They're forgetting the population of the actual countries that they're talking about. And I think you're right that if rather than this social democratic big state welfare system, they had this hard libertarianism, it probably would have worked well too because of the human capital. I don't know. I would say that in countries like Britain, Canada, the United States, it definitely, like, I think that the multiculturalism, that entire agenda was malicious from the get-go. I think that that was imposed with malicious intent. However, I don't know very much about Scandinavia at all, but I listen to Frody's show quite often. And one thing that a few of the stories he's told about, like how Greg Johnson was arrested by the Norwegian authorities when he was there to attend a conference, but then the Norwegian authorities actually just realized that the report of him being this domestic terrorist was false, and then they even apologized to him, and they shook his hand and they said, "Oh well, we're sorry about that." It feels like, at least from my limited knowledge that I'd have of Scandinavia, it feels like they're a lot more genuinely liberal, in that they in that they just have this genuine belief that that this is the right thing to do and this is what makes you a good person. Whereas in the West, I think it's more pushed for because Sweden is part of the West. In let's say the Anglosphere, I think it does have a lot more of the malicious nature behind it. And Frodi even said that he would never have tried the same thing in Britain because the politeness of the Norwegian state, he knows he would never get something like that from the British state.
I mean, it's going a little bit off from Demolition Man, but I actually me and my mate spent in 2009, spent 3 weeks backpacking around Norway. And for the first week, we tried hitchhiking because that was him being daft. We ended up getting a car, but we were hitchhiking around heading towards Bergen from Oslo. I mean, look, it is spectacular. The people are gorgeous. Everybody's lovely. Really, it was beautiful. It really was. But we actually got picked up by an overt communist in a camper van. And he had this old drunk in the passenger seat. And what he was doing was they've got these little sort of lodges out in the Norwegian countryside where people in the city, they go out and spend weekends in these lodges. And he had a team of pools at work. Anyway, he was absolutely adamant. I was complaining about the diversity that I'd seen in Oslo. Obviously, I didn't expect it. They just seem out of place. I don't know what you're thinking. What are you doing? And he was adamant that, like, we, meaning sort of Europeans in general, we'd had our time in the sun, and now Islam is now rising, and this is just the ebb and flow of civilization. And I was saying, like, it really isn't. Like, these are policies being brought in. They're policies that can be scrapped. Like, this can be stopped immediately and reversed. And it could as well, because you wouldn't, you know, but 2009, it wasn't that much in Oslo. But I could see that was starting. And he actually, I mean, we argued quite a lot. And this is like 2009. So I wasn't as clued up on all this as what I am now. You know what I mean? Yeah. But he this is a true story. He ended up, we camped out on this mountaintop, and we were in tents, and he was in the camper van, and he pissed off in the middle of the next morning, early in the morning, and just left us on the mountain. Because I'd argued with him all the way into the night, and then he must have thought, I've had enough of this fascist. We got up the next morning, we were supposed to carry on towards Bergen, and he was just gone. Communist twat dumped us on the side of a mountain because I wasn't going along with his bullshit ideology. That's a true story.
No, I believe it with that type of guy. Kind of tying it back into Demolition Man. So again, they have this prosperous society. Not that it's necessarily a good one, but when there actually is an outside threat, they have to go then dig up Sylvester Stallone, bring him out of, I don't know, being frozen in carbonite or whatever it's called in the movie. They have to dig out the old masculine man who actually knows how to deal with a hardened criminal, because everyone in the society, they've become so weak and so infantilized, and they're so safe and comfortable that any amount of danger that is just totally alien to them. So they have to go and dig up the masculine white man from decades gone by to solve their problems for them. Well, I mean, does that not sound familiar too? But I think though that what you can draw from that is that while you may have this homogenous, everybody wants this homogenous, safe, prosperous, wealthy society. But then, you know, how do you actually keep that? And I think you have to hold on to the more, the more vicious side of humanity as well, because you need to have an iron fist facing the rest of the world. So, you know, at home, it may be peace. At home, it may be, Scandinavia in the 1980s. But how do you keep it that way? Well, you need to get really vicious with anyone who would possibly come in and threaten that. So I think that you can have a safe society like that, but as long as you never lose sight that in order that this is not the human human norm. In order to preserve something like this, you kind of got to be a bit rich. You got to be a bit vicious.
Yeah, I mean, I think to sort of start and round it off a bit, what appeals to me as well about this kind of film is the fish out of water element. It just so happens that in this case, it's like much closer to home than usual. But there is something to be said when you get to a certain age and you're looking around you and you have a hard time. I mean, I pointed out this morning on Zitter that there was a difference between like a 23-year-old woman seducing teenage boys and like a male pedophile, and everybody lost. I got so much shit for that, and I just think and what it came down to was that so many of the Zoomers in the replies were like saying, no, this is abuse, it's all just abuse, and I was like, well, teenage boys and teenage girls are different. There's a difference in all of this. It's not very pleasant to talk about, but it's not the same. You're different. And then I kind of came to the conclusion that maybe like the Zoomers just are female inside, like the psychology and everything, like what people say. It's not something that I've took much interest in, but I was thinking, but are you a victim because you got seduced because you're like 15 or 16? Now, in the case of this story, it was like it was a little bit dodgy. She did seem to be like a complete nutcase, but what I'm trying to get at is that these days you like a woman will go to jail for raping like a 16-year-old boy, and it's as if like what they have done is make it equal. So it's like, even though in my view it's not the same at all. Like everybody, when I was a teenage boy, you couldn't get enough of bloody nudity, and everybody was talking about yummy mummies and older women and all of that kind of thing. And I just think, I just have a hard time. What I'm trying to get is, whether you agree with that take or not, a lot of people didn't. But when I was like 16, it would, like, if you came home and you were 15 or 16 and you said, I've had sex with like the 23-year-old woman, you would have been a hero. And you certainly wouldn't have felt like a victim. But this is just things change, and you end up where you're like, you're just like this kind of dinosaur that's wandering around. I don't understand the world anymore. this if this is what's normal now, and like every boy under 18 is just a girl inside or whatever. Like, yeah, maybe it's me. Maybe it's not them. Maybe it is me. Maybe it is like I'm just this dinosaur. I did an article on Substack about a month ago about the coelacanth, the fish, where everybody thought it was extinct, but it popped up, this prehistoric fish. Like, it's still there, like out of time and out of kilter with all of the values and all of the other fish that's around. It's just this relic of a different era. And Demolition Man's like that. I kind of got it beyond the politics, beyond all of the stuff we've been discussing. I just kind of got with the vibe that he's wandering around sort of confused and baffled by what's happened to the world. I spend my life like that these days.
Well, I guess that's not as much the case for me, as I'm quite a bit younger. But I can definitely see that among the Zoomer crowds. I don't know if I want to go on a whole spiel about Zoomers this late in the stream, but I can see where you're coming from on that, though.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I do think she was a nutcase in this particular case, but any parting shots on Demolition Man?
Well, I'd say that I wouldn't consider it a great film. It's kind of fun. It's kind of a few interesting themes. You know, worth a watch, but I don't expect to be blown away. But, you know, I think it made for a good stream.
All right. So have you got any ideas what we'll be doing next month?
Yeah, I think we're going to be doing The Road.
Oh, all right. Right. Well, I'm not. Are you going to read the book as well? How prepared do I need to be?
I think we're just going to go with the movie. It's classic movies, not classic books.
All right. All right, well, thanks for tuning in there, folks, and I'll catch you next time on Endeavor's channel.